Yes, man, me down to the ground. annihilated, everything enters into the Supreme Lord, Krishna, and varieties are no longer manifested. Report. As stated by the Lord Himself in the Bhagavad Gita 7:19, Vahunam Janamante Kanavamam Rabadyante Vasudevam Saraviti Salahatmasa Jodhavam. After many births and deaths, he who is actually acknowledged surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Vasudeva, is one with the Supreme Brahman, the Supreme Absolute Truth. Everything is in him in the beginning, and in the end, all manifestations enter into him. He has situated everyone's heart, Sarasya Chaham Vidisanivishta. And from him, everything has emanated, Janadishayata. All material manifestations, however, are temporary. The word svapna means dreams, maya means illusions, and manorita means mental creations. Dreams, illusions, and mental creations are temporary. Similarly, all material creation is temporary, but Vasudeva, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is the eternal, absolute truth. Om Yam Kuvanishan Ganajanas Vajanachashun Kazmashun Vajipal Kutiris Chakrips and Davis and Vajitano Bhavan Vajishan. So, first, it's very wonderful, very nice to be back home in Alachua. Alachua definitely feels like home. Even though it's very nice to visit the Holy Dhams, it's also particularly ecstatic to return here and to again do the darshan of the most beautiful deities in the world. As I always say, that's not a question of subjective opinion, that's actually the truth. So anyway, so much appreciating the wonderful association of devotees and deities here. I'll speak a little bit about this verse, and I'll spend a few minutes talking about some of the a few things about India and some of the GBC meetings, just to give a little bit of a report on what we do there. So, in this verse, Shukadeva Goswami is speaking, but he's more or less telling the story of Yayati and Yayati's realization. He heard about Yayati's being able to enjoy the material world by dint of having the youth that was given to him by his son. But now it's also describing how Yayati is also a person of deep spiritualization. And so this realization in this particular verse that Shukadeva Goswami sort of inserts in his story is an example of that realization and understanding that Yayati has. So this is a very nice verse in purport, because we are actually getting a very deep and complete understanding of the Supreme Absolute Truth. This gives us an understanding which is beyond the superficial, or beyond a less in-depth realization of the Supreme. Actually, even the word, I was thinking about this as a description of gods, but actually the word God is even somewhat inadequate. I think someone was discussing this in class, maybe it's Nagaraj or something, that actually the words used in the Vedic literature are much more all-encompassing. We use even the translations are words like Supreme Absolute Truth, Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we have this very, very complete understanding of not only God the person, but God in all his energies, God as he interacts with this material universe, and as he also interacts with the jiva souls. So all this is included within the concept of the Supreme Absolute Truth. So here we have this very interesting relationship between Krishna and his energies are being described. And Prabhupada nicely explains this in this purport, how one understands Krishna as the supreme cause of all causes, how one understands how Krishna interacts with the material energy and the actual relationship of the material energy, which is being described in this particular verse by the words svapna and maya vinorita as illusion, as dreamlike. So that's important to understand, because the impersonal philosophers also would agree. They say, yes, this material world is maya, it is dreamlike, it is simply an illusion. But the Vaishnavas, Vaishnavas have a little different understanding, more complete understanding of these relationships. So it's quite possible to make many philosophical mistakes in trying to understand this intricate relationship between God and his variegated energies. Some of these misconceptions that we see are, first of all, of course, we see the atheists and materialists have this very simplistic understanding that everything is a product of material interaction. We see this in modern science, simply an idea that there is a chemical or physical interaction of material elements, and this is bringing everything into being. Of course, those who are a little bit deeper, a little more philosophical, usually reject this kind of simplistic argument. And others will propound that there is some type of God, or there is some type of spiritual experience which is on material. But even that is not very well known or very well understood, particularly in our Western philosophies. Often there is so many different speculations about the nature of what is absolute, or what is God, or what is supreme, but very little clear understanding of these concepts. During the so-called Age of Enlightenment, during the 18th century, it's the so-called Age of Enlightenment, because in the Age of Enlightenment they decided they actually had less faith in religion and more faith in the new upcoming science, so I'm not quite sure why I call it Age of Enlightenment, but that's what it's called. One of the philosophies that was characteristic then that became prominent by many philosophers and some of our people like Thomas Jefferson kind of took up some of these ideas was a philosophy called deism. Deism basically means that, yes, there is a God. In fact, the deist even had some proofs for the existence of God, so they did recognize that. But then they were very unclear as far as what did God do. The analogy they often gave was of a watchmaker. God is the watchmaker. In other words, he builds the watch, winds it up, and you kind of let it go. So in other words, once you've got the watch and you've gone home with it, the watchmaker has nothing more to do with it. It simply does its thing, it winds, it's wound up, it ticks, it keeps time, and that's it. So that's an idea that was quite popular for a while there. In fact, probably still there are philosophers of the school, that God really didn't have much to do with the direct intercession with human beings or living entities. In other words, he got the plan in motion and sort of stepped back and let it unfold. And therefore, they didn't have very little faith in anything like miracles or direct relationship with God or anything of that sort. Now, of course, this is exactly that philosophy that's being refuted by this verse in purport, as we are learning here, quite the contrary, that Krishna is pervading everything. And he is not only the cause of all causes, but he is very much a part of everything. In fact, there is nothing that is apart from Krishna. There's nothing that is different from God. Everything is a part and parcel of God. Everything is connected and related to him. You know, so that's something that we learn. We get this much higher knowledge here from the Vedas and from the Srimad Bhagavatam. But then one could also think, all right, if I accept that, as it's stated here, that the Supreme Absolute is pervading everything, like the sky that holds the clouds. Everything after annihilation enters back into him. Therefore, one could think that actually everything is simply spiritual. Everything is simply Brahman, and that there's no variegatedness. Or somehow, when God becomes everything, he might lose his identity. So again, these kind of mistakes are very easy for the conditioned soul to come about. But we can understand that God does not lose his identity, that he is simultaneously both within the creation and he is without the creation. Everything is coming from him, but he does not lose his separate identity. In Bhagavad Gita 9.4 explains this. He says, by me and my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. In other words, he does not lose his identity. He does not become merged disembodied or spread out all of his existence in the different living entities. Rather, it's the other way around. They are part of him. They are with him, within him. But he does not ever lose his original identity. Now, and we might also think that that this material world is temporary, that doesn't have an existence. So, in one sense, we hear that Krishna and is described by these terms, svapnamaya manorata. It is simply a dream or simply an illusion. So the impersonalist philosophers will take something like this and say, yes, it is simply an illusion. It's simply a dream, it doesn't actually exist. But we can hear, we can see from the purports of the great Vaishnavas and Srila Prabhupada, a very clear understanding that the material world certainly does exist. It is Krishna's, Krishna says, the verse in the 7th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, 4:6, Krishna talks about his, the material elements, he talks about the gross elements, the subtle elements, and then he talks about the living entity. All of these, and he calls these his separated, bina, separated material energies. So they are his energy, they are coming from him, but they are somewhat separate at the same time. So in other words, we can't say that the material energy is Krishna, or Krishna is only composed of material energy. No, this is one of his separated energies. And of course he says, in the first of all that is material and all that is spiritual in this world, know for certain that I am both the origin and the disillusion. So to think that the living entity and God are identical is another type of illusion that we have. We might think that is Krishna, does he enter into the material world? No, that can be seen not to be the case. But one might think, well, the living entity ultimately is at the same spiritual quality. It's also Brahman. This is actually true. The living entity and Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, are qualitatively similar. They have the same spiritual qualities. But the distinction is always there. That Krishna is very great and the living entities are very small, and never does our existence merge into them, the Supreme. Krishna says, of course, in Bhagavad Gita 2:14, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of this cease to be. So right in the very beginning of the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna begins to give his instructions to Arjuna, one of the first things that he establishes is the eternal identity of both himself and of Arjuna, the living entity. So Krishna is there eternally, the jiva soul is there eternally. It's not that they were ever merged together, and it's not that they will somehow at some point come back together and lose their separate identity. So these are very important concepts that our Vedic literatures, and Bhagavad Gita in particular, make very, very clear. And so the devotees can understand this. But even those who study the Vedas often do come to these misunderstandings. Those who are in terms of my body, I think in one class recently someone asked, what's the difference between a personalist and Maya body? The understanding I have is the Brahma bodies or the impersonalist jnanis, they're of course trying to study the nature of the absolute truth and distinguish between matter and spirit. So they actually have some sincerity as transcendentalists in their effort to try to understand what is spirit. Where they make a mistake, of course, is that they are, of course, seeing that all God's incarnations and all of the expansions are spiritual energy, which is true, but they think that ultimately the essence is Brahman. So what they've done is they've confused the direction of causality. In other words, they're more or less thinking that, you know, Brahman is absolute, and different variegated manifestations of the Brahman, such as the incarnations of Krishna, emanate from that. And ultimately, of course, it's, you know, the spiritual energy itself is absolute, where we understand, of course, the opposite is the case. Krishna very clearly states that he is the source of the Brahman effulgence, that everything is coming from him. And while we can see that there are the different features of Krishna, it's not that Krishna is not, does not have impersonal energy. He does. All features of Krishna are there. And so the impersonal feature is one feature of the Brahman energy, is the bodily effulgence of Krishna. The Paramatma, the Supersoul, is there. That is one of Krishna's expansions, one of his features. But the devotee understands that there's a certain hierarchy of understanding of these different features of the Lord. They're not, they're all there, and they're all something that we appreciate. And in fact, the Srimad Bhagavatam and other literatures do have quite a bit of understanding of these different features. You can see in the teachings of Kapila Dev or the teaching of Jetta Bharat through Rahugana, the process of jnana is actually stress to some degree, the process of understanding spirit. But at the same time, within all of those teachings of the Sri Bhagavatam, ultimately, devotion or bhakti is always mentioned as the supreme practice. So while we have the different practices of jnana, practice of even the meditation upon the Paramatma, in the second canto, Srimad Bhagavatam, all of these things are there, but they're put in a particular context. And the expertise, of course, of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the teachings of Sri Goswami, Sutta Goswami, is that they give us that context of understanding all of these different concepts and all of these different practices. And of course, Srila Prabhupada expounds upon these also expertly in his purports, so that we can understand that these are all subsidiary or subordinate processes to the processes of Bhakti Yoga. So our philosophy, of course, was best enunciated by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who gave us this very, very incredible, sublime philosophy of the Chintaveda-Veda Tattva. And through the understanding of Chintaveda-Veda Tattva, everything becomes very clear. It's actually, in some ways, it's a very deep, complex philosophy. It's also very simple. I probably said, for the simple and difficult for the curriculum. So it approaches the ending of Krishna conscious philosophy from the basis of devotion, with a little bit of sincerity and a little bit of sincere inquiry, and also, very, very importantly, the quality of being able to surrender to Krishna. Without the quality of humility, of surrender, it's very difficult to understand. But if one does approach in that way, then one can understand that Krishna, the living entity, are qualitatively one, they're quantitatively different, that Krishna has both personal and impersonal features, that Krishna keeps his identity despite his pervading throughout the entire material universe, that nothing is different from Krishna. Everything is part of Krishna. There's nothing that is separate from him. But yet Krishna retains his identity through the expansion of his variegated energies. And this is how we understand, in the verses like this, how we understand how Krishna works in this material world. That he works through his energies, through his different expansions. In this way, he retains his identity. Jiva retains his identity of loving service to Krishna. And the material world is being manifest and unmanifest. Those energies are coming into being. They are dissolving again, over and over again, through Krishna's will. So these are, of course, very important understandings that we get from Srimad Bhagavatam. And once we understand these things, everything becomes quite clear, actually quite simple. And we don't become bewildered by so many different types of philosophies or different types of understandings of these things. So I'm going to stop there and just talk a little bit about our recent meetings in Mayapur. If there are any question or comment about before we lose this? Prabhu.
Yeah.
philosophical tradition, so if I slip up a little bit, he keeps me on the right track. I appreciate that. Thank you. Okay. I think, what was the last one? I think I misquoted the evolutionist or something that you caught me on. Okay. I'll just, of course, I just got back from India. I was in Mayapur and Vrindavan, and we had our GBC meetings in Mayapur. Which means that I saw almost nothing in Mayapur outside of a small room, you know. So it wasn't exactly a total transcendental experience, but, you know, I'm getting more and more realization that sometimes the realization and the advancement that we get in Krishna consciousness is really based more upon our service than, you know, the ability to just sort of appreciate or enjoy, you know, our circumstances. But the GBC resolutions haven't all been put together and completed, so I can't really, you know, give those out yet. They've got to run through the lawyers, you know, before we send that down. Seriously, we do. it takes a little time, you know, to get all that official approval that we don't say something wrong and, you know, and have some kind of dire results. But I do want to talk a little bit about one of the things, I've mentioned this before, is the strategic planning emphasis has become much more increased in recent years, particularly about the last 4 or 5 years. And now we're, of course, meeting twice a year. We meet in October, as well as the annual governance meeting in Mayapur. And the October meeting, usually it's been in Mumbai recently, has been exclusively on strategic planning. So what is strategic planning? I mean, basically, without getting into a long, complicated description, it's really planning the future of ISKCON. It's planning the future of our movement. And we haven't always done a lot of that. Because whenever, of course, we're in these meetings, there's a lot of crises, and there's a certain amount of operational things you have to do, and you've got to just keep things running, and you've got to deal with the latest disaster in some part of the country where some leader, you know, left, you know, in the middle of the night or whatever it was. And so all those things have to be there. But we realize that we also have to take time and carve out 4 or 5 days out of each meeting where we really think proactively, we really think about the future, and think about, you know, how are we going to lead this, you know, lead this movement in a good shape. I think particularly those of us who are some of the older, you know, I guess we're all a bit old now, the Prabhupada disciples and senior devotees, we don't have that much time left, and, you know, we're not real satisfied with the legacy that we're leading at this point, and, you know, we want to try to get it together a little bit, you know, while we're still around and still active. So the strategic planning has been a very, very, I think, important and powerful addition to what we've been doing. Chris Gopalabhadra Prabhu has been our major facilitator and instigator of that process, and is a very, very good team with him. Matsumoni Mataji is part of that team, that work that helps with strategic planning. And so that's really been a great source of guidance and direction that's helped the GBC. So one of the things, of course, we've done is we've developed several standing GBC committees, and those have been around for about 4 years now. We have one on the Constitution that Shesha Prabhu is doing, and I'm working on the Leadership Succession Committee and Leadership Training. We have a Parallel Lines of Authority Committee trying to sort out, you know, as you all know, anyone who's been around more than 10 days around here, that, you know, we have, of course, the managerial structure for the GBC, the telepresence, everything. And we also have each individual devotee has a connection with their group. So you have, you know, you have actually sort of two different lines of authority. And both, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. Both of them are good and both of them need to be there. But how do they work together? How do they work in synchrony and synthesize? And that's been a very important thing we've been trying to deal with. We have a committee that's been just for establishing Srila Prabhupada's position. Now, that might seem very obvious right now, Srila Prabhupada's position, but think about in 1, 2, 3 generations, 100 years from now, will it be so clear that, you know, that Srila Prabhupada, as Srila Prabhupada said, his law books, you know, his books will be the law books for thousands of years, you know, that Srila Prabhupada is our preeminent authority in this time. So we want to make sure that we have that firmly established and we have those things in place. And also, there's an outreach committee, a devotee care committee, has been very active. They've done a lot. They've done a lot of work, and they're starting to really spread throughout the world and develop a lot of programs. We have a team building committee. And more recently, the organizational development committee has been very, very important as far as trying to establish our internal and external structure. So all these are like standing GBC committees that are meeting regularly. And then we've also, just recently, in the last two sessions, brought in a lot more devotees. And this has been very, very important. We had to get ourselves established and really this sort of culture of planning and strategies, you know, established. You have to have a certain amount of, you know, cultural readiness for these things to really happen, really happen and manifest. But once that was at a certain point, then we wanted to really bring in a lot more devotees. So like 50 to 75 additional devotees have been coming to these meetings for the Shuji planning portion. And they've had different initiatives and breakup groups and tackling different issues, anything from some of these groups of talking things like local finance, what is membership, trying to define that, gurus of the future, conflict of interest policies, what is kind of culture? How do we interact with the greater culture? How does this kind of culture interact with itself? I mean, all of these questions are kind of there that are different groups have been looking at and trying to bring these out. And some of these initiatives then became sort of a permanent initiative or permanent, they formed their own committee, like rural development. Bhakti Raghavaswamy, you know, was very involved with that. And so those people who are interested in farms and agriculture, they're now like a permanent committee that's continuing to meet and work on this issue. Another one, Bhaktivinoda Swami formed a creative arts. How we use creative arts in preaching. Very important. You know, plays, dance, all those things. And so we have now people like permanent these. They're not like full, because they're like these other groups that are sort of like they create their own life. So a lot of this is actually, some of it is top down and remote. It's been great grassroots too. Devotees come together and they get involved in something and something seems to be working. And then sometimes it carries on its own life, and it continues onward from that point. You know, so these are, you know, this is one level that we've been working on, the strategic planning. And of course, there's also very active things like the Organizational Development Committee and the Strategic Planning Team also working on these larger issues of structure. What kind of structure do we need to sustain, to subsist, to be able to continue and build and grow and spread Krishna consciousness? One of the issues that we've been working with is trying to develop an executive structure. Now, an executive structure, that simply means the operational management. Think about, what do you know about the operational management of the international side of ISKCON, the GBC and the international management? Do you know a lot about how that structure works? You probably don't because there isn't any. Or there's very little, right? I mean, there's really very little in operation. Sometimes people think, you know, there's some kind of big monolithic, you know, people at the top and they're controlling everything. And, you know, if that were true, our life might be a little easier now. I mean, it's actually, there's very little centralized, organized management within the system. That's the truth of the matter. The GBC is almost more like a board or a legislative board, you know, but there's no executive structure. Just like we have a board of directors here. And so, you know, the board of directors, you know, meets once a month and they talk about some things, some strategies and some things we should do. And, you know, but would much go on if we didn't have our management team actually executing it? We didn't have the temple president, the vice president, the trade, you know, they're the ones that do all the work, right? You know, the ones who actually get things done. So in the same way, we don't have much of a structure that goes beyond, you know, once the GBC leaves the meeting room. Now, things happen in individual zones, of course. I mean, many GBC people are very active, work with different projects, they work with temples. They're doing many, many wonderful things all over the world. I mean, I'm not saying that they're not. But in terms of an organized structure, not much is really happening. Plus, there's no budget. The GBC has almost no money. There's just a very, very small budget. You know, what little comes in from the temple donations, a few $100 from each temple, which we have a treasurer whose full-time job is to try to run that down and try to collect that money during the year, which is very difficult. So, you know, this is kind of what we have. And the other thing is that there hasn't been much accountability or oversight of the individual GBCs. That's the truth of it. You know, it's like, what, I mean, who really knows? Are we wrong?
Well,
I don't know.
Well,
it's not working. No, but the truth of it is we don't have, it's very simple, we just don't have much oversight. I mean, what each of us is individually doing, I mean, What do we really know? Unless there's a problem, you know, unless something completely messes up, somebody falls down, or there's some big, you know, problem that all of a sudden, you know, gets on the radar, we don't really know. So we need an executive strategy. We actually need an executive function that gives oversight and also gives support. That part of it, it's more than just oversight. We also need support. You know, we need help in these different areas and departments, and often there's not really centralized focus. So some of these different committees, which are in some of these different areas, those committees will actually end up sort of being an oversight along with the executive branch of different divisions. So the idea is that we need to have actually a director, an operations director, or a, not exactly chief executive officer, he doesn't have quite that much power, but somebody who's really watching that everything is going on. For instance, every year we pass 20 or 30, used to be 50 or 80 resolutions. They used to go crazy. They pass 100 resolutions. How many of those do you think got enacted? How many of those were followed up? How many people can remember what those are 3 years later? You know, so it's like I should turn this off.
Sometimes we pass a lot of legislation and it becomes almost irrelevant as far as the average devotee is concerned. Isn't it? I mean, how many people, doesn't anybody even know what the last few years of GBC resolutions were? I can't even remember them, you know, because the fact is we don't have any mechanism to follow up. And we looked at a lot of these resolutions and found a lot of them were really good. And it
isn't that anyway, it isn't that this stuff is trivial. It's actually important. But we haven't had good follow-up. We haven't had good management structures. So that's what we've really been thinking about and trying to work on. So we wanted to have, and in fact, we have a very good person, Ramai Swami, who's a GBC member from Australia, who's willing to do this, to take on this job as sort of executive. What is that position actually called? Do you remember?
Yeah, it's the executive director.
The executive director. An executive director in the ideal world, when our funding gets together, will have about 10 or 12 divisional directors working under him. So we'll have a divisional director for these major areas, like succession planning, like finance, like legal compliance issues. You know, do we even know the temples are even legally structured right? Do they have their property trustees in order? Do they even know who their board of directors are? And we've been trying to work on this in North America, but internationally, there's all kinds of, you know, weak areas like this. And we also have the divisional director of devotee care, of education, of different, you know, we'll have, you know, some very, it's not just, you know, oversight, structure, legalities. It's also very positive programs as far as spreading Krishna consciousness and helping devotees. So all those things need to be there. And then at the same time, actually some of us, and like I said, we do have the director, and we have some of the divisional directors are in place, and we're hopefully going to actually enact several of these over this next year. And over the next year, we hope to have several of these divisions in place, which will start giving some real tangible help to the devotees and to the temples. Mostly by working with the leaders. They're not going to come into a temple and start telling people what to do. It's not like that. Actually, they'll mostly work with the GBC people. It'll be on our case. You know, are we getting our stuff done? Are we, are our temples getting reports and that kind of thing? They're not going to be, you know, hounding individual temple presidents. That's not the idea. They're supposed to be support offices that can give resources and help. And the other thing that we're also doing is trying to really look through the organizational development committees. What do we see as our future? Where are we going? Are we just going to have unlimited zones as we grow? We will grow. We know Lord Chaitanya's Mahaprabhu's movement is going to grow exponentially over the next few thousand years, right? There'll be hundreds, thousands of temples. There'll be, you know, devotees, millions of devotees. What is our structure for accommodating this? It's like we haven't developed much of a structure. Almost says we don't have faith that we're really going to do it. Well, and we are going to do it. So we're asking questions like, well, how many GDCs do we need? And what do we do when we keep having to have more and more layers, you know, of oversight and responsibility, and what kind of structure would that look for? And does it make any sense that we have a GDC person who has a zone in Siberia, South Africa, Estonia, or somewhere else, and someone else has one in Fiji, So these are things we're looking at. And we're actually, you know, and these are going to take time because a lot of these systems have grown up over time and they're based upon certain relationships that people have. You're not going to sever those relationships immediately and, you know, force things on people. And, you know, I mean, the thing is you can't really always blame the GDC because you have a case where somebody's out in this temple that's 8,000 miles away from the rest of the person's zone. And they say, no, that's the person I want to work with. I don't want anybody else. So, you know, it works both ways. You've got different situations, but what we're trying to do is work on a general plan that makes sense if you took the personalities out. Now, that's impossible to do because we're a personal movement and you can't take the personalities out, but we're building towards the future. That's the idea. We want to see what is a rational plan that we're going to have that's going to be a sustainable movement, that's going to be able to sustain growth, and is going to be able to continue to be able to lead in preaching Krishna consciousness, growing this movement, taking care of the devotees that we have, which is a huge thing. You know, Prabhupada said, what's the point of making so many devotees if they're all leaving, coming one door and out the other? We don't want that either. So there has to be a number of systems put in place. And so these are some of the things that I think that we're working on that are in kind of a more proactive, more progressive way, instead of just, you know, dealing with the latest crisis or disaster. So, I mean, both things have to go on, but these are some of the things that we're working on. And, anybody? I kind of run a little bit over, but if anyone has a question, anything at this point? Anything?
I'm wondering if there's any discussion about having the brewers be gurus and the management be management.
There's some, yeah, that's always part of the discussion. I mean, I would say that these discussions, you know, usually that topic is always there in the mix. You know, should they be, because that's part of it. You have sometimes an overlap, you know, where a person is a guru and a person is also a manager. And sometimes that causes difficulties. I don't know if we can get away from that right now. Unfortunately, a lot of our really effective good leaders are also gurus, so I don't know how we get away from that entirely. You know, but certainly that's part of the thought process, that's part of the discussion that's going on. How does that work together? Or can one separate those roles? You sometimes have to act as a GDC member or a temple president, and sometimes as the spiritual leader or the guru, and they're two different things. You know, and you have to almost like recognize that and make that separation. You know, if you can't make it literally physically, maybe you have to at least make it in terms of operations that time. You know, so yeah, those discussions are definitely there. And there's a lot of thinking about this. The Parallel Lines Committee will be coming out with their papers soon. They've been working over years. And of course, there's a lot of difference of opinion. So they present a paper and people don't like this part and like that part. And they go back to the drawing board and then kind of keep working on it. But we're really trying to sort that out in a way that's going to be workable. Because, and that's been part of this finance, it's money too. You know, we have a real financial problem in this movement because we don't have, you know, good sources of finance. We don't always have strong support. And there again, you've also got the two parallel tracks. You know, you've got, and as far as anything going upward, it doesn't happen at all. As far as, you know, the greater projects, basically money comes in. Then our global finance committee made this presentation, so I'll say it's what they said. So I don't have to. Anyway, but the global finance committee was saying that basically the money comes in and stops at two places, either at the temple project level or at the guru level. So in other words, you've got, and within sometimes there's competition there. So that needs to be sorted out. That needs to be sorted out. You know, where, you know, how this is all going to come together and how everyone's going to work cooperatively, you know, for the same ends. You know, but right now, as far as anything, as far as larger projects or things that need to be done on a regional level or an international level, the funding just isn't getting there. So, again, these are things we're trying to sort out. Krishna.
They're independent. That's the whole idea of the GDC, right? And they don't publish published on Thunderbox, right?
Yeah.
So we never really get feedback. We don't see, I'm not closing my heart, but feedback from GDCs, do they, how do they, what their opinion is of it? Is it taken as, that's it, we follow that, or is it just some thing they just throw out there, no one blasphemes it, tears it down? Or
well,
how does that work?
You know, of course, the term is advisory committee, so it is advisory. But they are usually commissioned by the GDC to, you know, to research, you know, different issues from the spiritual perspective, to get the Shastric references, and, you know, really to get deeply into a particular topic. And usually when their papers are published, I think they have, you know, they're pretty much accepted. At least there's a majority acceptance of that. I mean, I think there's always minority opinions, you know, always different perspectives. And we had to revive the committee's down a little bit right now, only had 4 members. It's supposed to have 6 to 12, so we're trying to build that back up and get more members on that committee. It's very important.
6 to 12. Never had 12.
No. I mean, it's charter. It's when it was, you know, whatever, commission. It's supposed to have 6 to 12.
You've had, like, GDCs going around saying that if someone's guru had a problem, that person or persons would have to go back and become new bhaktas again. And which was completely independent of the entire GDC. So, I mean, it's completely incomprehensible. All these things are not reined in. If someone goes around speaking that something's completely off in the GDC, why these things are not dealt with swiftly? Well, that's a small thing with the speaker, you know,
yeah.
Rate of deviation. That's a small philosophical thing, you know, but that might impress a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, then, like, we're going to not become a bhakti again, you know, after 30 years or something.
I think those systems are getting more in place. And I think they have the problems in the past, but I think that more and more this idea of trying to, well, I mean, it's centralization, but, you know, that always has a bad tone. People don't like that. You have this very independent idea in this time. And of course, you know, Prabhupada encouraged that to a certain degree. The thing is, as I understand it, you know, Srila Prabhupada encourage two sort of juxtaposed, simultaneous concepts of one of, you know, training independent, thoughtful devotees, and also having, you know, an organized worldwide preaching movement. So somehow we're always trying to put those two together. You know, to have a certain amount of organization that's necessary to be able to be efficient and, you know, and being able to accomplish your goals, and at the same time allow that independence of spirit, independence of initiative, it's there. So I think sometimes the balance